Transportation and Workforce Development Committee will be in order. Today's date is Thursday, March 6, 2014. So, members and those in the audience, at our first committee hearing, we shared about the tour that we did around the state. We went to 21 colleges and universities and did listening sessions with our students. And so we tried to show a very brief video to give you a sense of the spirit of that visit, and we had technical difficulties. So literally, it's 2 minutes, but I really wanted people to have a chance to see it. So we're going to start the committee by doing that. If you're sitting in the audience and you want to see this great video, you're welcome to come up into the sides to take a look at it. And then also, I want you to see Sean, who's right there, if you point to our poster. So what we did after we did the listening sessions, after each listening session, the students would come up and put their sticker on our board, and then we got the board framed. And it was really a beautiful thing, and we would do a big photo of the legislators who were present as well as the students. And this board, as you can see, is now very full. So with that, I will ask Brad Shapiro, who came to almost all of them until he was away. But so we always had somebody from our media department doing the video and making sure that the students were able to stay in touch with us during the whole tour. Thanks, Brad.
I know I speak with people who recently graduated, people who are about to graduate, and people in my shoes, they got at least a year before they graduate. We don't know where we're going to find these jobs. That they say the job market's growing, but we don't necessarily see it.
Just having tutors is really hard, especially for nursing students. I think it's really hard to find tutors.
Tuition rates, book prices are very, very high.
The cost of tuition, miscellaneous costs, and the inconsistent job market once they're done.
The rising cost of tuition is really something that people are concerned about when they're starting to look at colleges. It certainly was when I was coming in as a freshman looking at schools, and am now dealing with student loans as I come out of college. I have a younger sister who's a senior in high school, and that's really what keeps her up the most at night.
It was a different, challenging conversation. It was fun to turn it back to them and say, well, tell me, what do you think? And the thing that I heard most from their students is, again, concern about the cost, the debt.
We had about, maybe 70 students. Every, student had a story to tell, and they weren't shy about telling it. They shared about their love and appreciation for technical education.
All the classes that I've taken, there's such a repetition of what you need to know and what you want to know and what to do and what not to do. And as I have grown older and I've taken more courses and we've gotten into more classroom discussions, it's always been, how can you apply this to real life? And that, I think, is the best part, is that we always bring it back to real life. It's not just a classroom anymore. It's going out into the field and doing things.
Very good. So thanks, members and those in the audience, for taking a look. We really do want to celebrate all those kids that are in our programs. Okay, so before we do our overviews, we're very pleased to have both Deed and Dolly with us today. We wanted to tackle the bills first, since we wanted to make sure members had a chance to hear them and vote. So we'll start with Senator Dahl. While we're waiting to Senator Dahl to come to the table, members, we did send out the survey that we had promised with regard to the bonding. It's very easy to do. It should take about 5 seconds. You just hit submit then, and we'll compile all that. We'd like all surveys back by next Friday.
Thank you. Did you email those? I didn't see.
Yes. Yep. Okay. The survey was emailed. It just went out today. I said yesterday, and it went out today. Thanks.
All right, Madam Chair and members, I think this might be my first time at higher ed, oddly enough.
Well, welcome, Senator Dahl.
4 or 5 years or so. I have a Senate file 2156. It's a pretty simple bill. It's a repealer, and what you're repealing is basically the pilot program for allowing alcohol at TCF Stadium. That is set to expire, and we think the experiment, if you will, is going well enough that maybe we can get rid of the repealer. I have with me Todd Iverson from the University of Minnesota, and he's going to tell you a little bit more and how things are going. Todd and I also are Northfield residents, and happy to be here today.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. This should be very quick. 2 years ago, the legislature passed a pilot program for the university to experiment with selling beer and wine in the bowl at TCF Bank Stadium. We took two real significant charges from the legislature for that pilot program. That we wanted to make the game experience at TCF the best fan experience we could, as well as making sure that it was safe for all of our fans to attend. And we took those charges very seriously. We have implemented a program around selling beer during the first half of the games. It ends at the end of halftime. We've had actually fewer incidents in the first year and about normal amount of incidents last year related to alcohol. We feel, and the Board of Regents feels, that the program has worked well. We would like to continue that, and that's what this bill accomplishes by repealing the sunset of that pilot program so that we can continue to do what we've been doing for the last 2 years. And if you have any questions, I have a few facts, but I'll leave it to the members if they have any questions about it. Otherwise, thank you for your time and consideration.
Mr. Iverson?
Yes.
With regard to when the Vikings play at the TCF Stadium, I assume they have a carve-out that's completely separate that's in their contract. Do you want to just share with members what that is?
Madam Chair and members, yes, they will be selling throughout the stadium, and there is an MOU or a Memorandum of Understanding between the Vikings and the university, and they'll be using our liquor license, but they will be selling it at a very different level than what we have been selling at.
Very good. Thank you. So any questions for the members? Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dahl, I'm wondering if you'd be open to a friendly amendment maybe to repeal the ban on Sunday sales liquor. It's with the bill. I think we could probably incorporate it one way or another.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Miller. I'm not going to touch that one.
You know, members, traditionally this bill hasn't been, this type of bill hasn't been heard in higher ed, and I was actually going to ask Senator Fischbach if she remembered whether or not they heard this one last time, but I thought it was important for us to just hear it. It's going to be referred back to Commerce with our positive vote, but I still thought, being we are the higher ed committee, it's important to hear it.
Well, and Madam Senator Chair, Fischbach, I don't remember, but I do have a question about Section 11 actually refers some other statutes. I'm trying to pull them up. Does anyone have copies of the statutes? I mean, we're repealing. Can I see a copy of them? Well,
Mr. Fuller, can you share that with her and give the committee a sense of what's else is in this bill?
It's on the back of the...
It is on the back?
That's all that...
Okay, but then there's... It repeals statutes that refer to other statutes, Madam Chair. That's what...
Mr. Fuller, could you just address the repealers that Senator Fischbach's asking about?
If you need this.
I do need this.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Laurie, I see you looking straight, but you see what I'm saying? It refers to other statutes, and so it's very, there's not
Madam
clearly
Chair,
what
Member
we're doing.
Mr. Iverson laid it out pretty straight in 2012?
I do see that.
No. Madam Chair.
There was a law passed that conditioned the Gopher, or the University of Minnesota license at the TCF Stadium, and it was sunsetted. So that authorization was sunsetted. So if we do nothing, if we don't repeal the sunset, that authorization is gone.
If we repeal the sunset, things stay the way they are.
And I mean, I can read what it is, but it's the term under which they serve liquor
at the stadium. And so those are the changes they're talking about in that law. Do you want me to read it?
I don't. Well, in Madam Chair, I just wanted to make sure that we weren't going, you know, because there was kind of an agreement made on how the liquor would be handled, and I just wanted to make sure that that's not.
We're not changing anything. We're continuing exactly what we have been doing for the last 2 years.
All right. Thank you.
Good. So Senator Miller moves, even though he doesn't get his amendment, Senator Miller moves that Senate file 2156 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Commerce Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion is passed. Thanks for stopping, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you.
We have a corner.
Oh, let's.
Senator Sharon.
Pardon?
I think I can vote yet.
You know.
I can't be missing a drinking bill.
Say aye real quick.
Aye.
There we go.
Do we need. I didn't say.
Senator Sharon.
Oh, Senator Sharon.
Yeah. Members, we did have a quorum. The only thing is I didn't say let the record reflect we have a quorum. But we did have a quorum. That's why we started. Thank you. So the record should reflect that we did have a quorum. Thank you. Thanks for being on top of that.
Welcome, Senator Boniff, to your committee.
Thank you,
it's nice
Mr.
to
Chair.
See you again in the
Thank you, Mr.
testifier
Chair.
Area.
So, members, this is we did the unsession bill at our last hearing. This is another agency bill cleaning up statutes. This is Senate File 2285. This is a recommendation from the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy. This bill changes the membership from the president of the Minnesota Association of Private College Students to a student who is enrolled in a private nonprofit post-secondary institution appointed by the Minnesota Private College Council. The bill also changes one member from a student from a private vocational school to a student from a for-profit post-secondary institution. This was brought forward by the students because the way that this the practice that they was outlined in statute was actually no longer being followed as they didn't have a president, and we had changed the wording around vocational, the private vocational school, to for-profit post-secondary institution in our statutes. And there is an amendment that reflects, originally when I got the bill from the agency, it was not consistent with what the student wanted, so we had an amendment drafted, and that's the A1 amendment that does reflect that change.
Senator, would you like to move the A1 at this time?
I would.
Okay. Senator Benoff moves the A1 amendment. Any questions, discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Very good. Passed.
Thank you. And then the other part of the bill is a repealer, and the repealer sunsets the Minnesota Academic Excellence Foundation, and Charlene Briner is here to share why that is something that the Commissioner of Education is recommending.
Thank you, Senator.
Welcome, Ms. Briner.
Thank you, Senator Claussen, and thank you, members. It's it's nice to be in higher ed after swimming in the K-12 pool and the pre-K 12 pool, so the water seems just fine here. The Minnesota Academic Excellence Foundation is a foundation that was created back in 1997. It had an appropriation and staff and was specifically designated and created to promote academic excellence, which is a noble and worthy endeavor. However, the appropriation was discontinued in 2002, and since that time, it's been difficult for, number one, for the foundation to fill open slots. They have struggled to define their mission. There are currently 7 activities and programs that could be administered by the foundation, and they are not currently engaged in any of them. I think it's fair to say that the activities of the foundation itself can be carried out effectively by the department with current resources without any existing appropriation. The Office of Indian Education is fully equipped to administer the Ethel Curry Scholarships to American Indian students. The waiver, which has designated reward and celebration schools, has created a recognition program that is quite sought after and effective in recognizing academic excellence. The one program, the Schools of Excellence program, that the board does still try to administer only had two applicants last year. And so I think it's fair to say that the board, while made up of very committed and thoughtful and dedicated Minnesotans who are concerned about academic excellence, I think that we could certainly utilize these members in more effective capacities in other advisory roles. I think I'd also share with you that the recommendation of the LCPFP was unanimous to repeal the MAFE Foundation, and they did engage in, while not significant or substantial conversation, there were also questions about the appropriate role of the legislature to actually create a nonprofit foundation. So I think that there are a lot of compelling reasons that we could utilize these thoughtful citizens in other capacities, and that the department is poised to take these responsibilities on.
Very good. Questions?
Mr. Chair, seeing yes. none, I move that Senate File 2285 as amended be recommended to pass.
Okay. We have a motion to pass Senate File 2285, Higher Education Office Student Advisory Council membership, and also the Minnesota Academic Excellence Foundation. All those, and we will be referring to state and local government on this. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Very good.
So at this time, I'd like to call on the Commissioner of Deed to come forward. And Mr. Norman is going to join Commissioner Katie Clark Sieben. And members, I had said it in our first overview that we wanted to take a look in this committee, given that we have the workforce side of our title. We wanted to take a look at what are the current workforce funds, where does the money come from, where does it go, both with the workforce development and the job skills partnership. So thank you for being responsive and for being here, and I would encourage members to ask lots of questions.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members. It's an honor to be here today, and thought this would be a great opportunity to introduce you to our new Workforce Development Director, Tom Norman. Our previous director, Bonnie Elsie, has retired, and so Tom joined us
3 months ago tomorrow.
and I thought Tom could just briefly share a little bit of information about his background.
Great. Mr. Norman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks very much for the opportunity to come and testify before your group. It's a pleasure to be here. I've spent my entire career in workforce development. Prior to coming to DEED, I worked as a senior administrator for the University of Minnesota for 14 years. Mm. Prior to that, I worked for a global HR consulting firm that was started at the university and works internationally, personnel decisions international. Prior to that, I had several leadership positions with Indeed and other employment and training activities.
Well, Mr. Norman, PDI was used by companies I've worked at, so I'm very familiar with them. Wonderful. They were Tonka Toys when I was there.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
So today we will be giving, as Madam Chair, as she mentioned, an overview of Deed's workforce programs. Please feel welcome to ask questions at any point. So to start out and just level set the conversation, a little bit about Minnesota's current economy. For over 150 years, we've been building on a culture of excellence, and our state has recovered extremely well from the recession. We're one of 18 states to attain pre-recessionary levels of employment in the country. Our current unemployment rate is 4.6% and is among the lowest in the country. And first-time applications for unemployment benefits continue to drop. We've created 133,000 jobs since the beginning of 2011. We had the fifth fastest GDP growth rate in 2012, and Forbes magazine listed us the eighth best state for business in 2013, jumping 12 spots, which was the largest jump of any state in that ranking. And we also were recently ranked fifth in Gallup's Job Creation Index. And the success is not by accident. It's because we've made very smart investments in education, workforce development, and economic development. And just one slide, obviously DEED is workforce development, but we are also economic development, focused on attracting and recruiting businesses to our state and also working hand-in-hand with Minnesota businesses as they are looking to expand and making sure that those expansions happen here in the state through business finance, community finance, small business assistance with our Angel Tax Credit, Minnesota Job Skills Partnership, the Trade Office, and the newly established Office of Broadband Development. Our Workforce Development Division, we are also working with companies in Minnesota. And one of the reasons why we consistently hear that companies are interested in expanding or relocating to Minnesota is because of the strong workforce that we have in here in the state, especially the productivity of our workforce. We work very closely with business, with higher education institutions, our K-12 schools, and other nonprofit service providers to create a network to build the world's best workforce across the state. We are focused on ensuring Minnesotans with barriers to employment and populations affected by disparities are receiving the training and support they need to find employment and increase skills and abilities. And we're funded by a variety of sources, but primarily through the federal government on the workforce development side of our organization. Federal funds come from a number of different programs. Some of those that you might be familiar with are WIA, the Workforce Investment Act, which provides funds for youth, adults, and dislocated workers. Wagner-Peiser, a part of the Workforce Investment Act, that provides funding for our workforce centers across the state. A lot of these federal dollars are distributed to our federally created workforce investment boards. There are 16 WSAs across the state, and each has a WIB, which is a board of business and education leaders from that local area. And some of these federal funds are also performance-based. So Minnesota has consistently received incentive grant funds from the federal government for our strong performance in our workforce development programs. Last year, we were one of 18 states that received those incentive dollars.
Commissioner Steben, could I just stop you for a moment?
Yeah.
Because this is a big part of, obviously, the funding that you get. So I just want to make sure that we spend a little more time on this part. Do you have the map of the service centers? Will you be going through that or not?
We do not have that in today's presentation. Yes, we do.
Oh, we do.
Never mind.
Okay. So I just want to, Commissioner Steben mentioned the funds that come federally go to the service area centers, and the service area centers then distribute the funds to the workforce centers. So you mentioned that we have 16 service area centers, and that I understand that's by choice. So some states have one. Some states have, you know, all different amounts. And I think it would be interesting for us to look at the comparison. Tell us about, you know, what does it take to keep a service area center afloat? Where does our money go to that when we deliver it to those service areas?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the resources are contracted annually through a unified planning process that each geographic area that's shown on the chart goes through. And in turn, each area unified plan is developed into a state plan that's forwarded to the federal government. And it's an excellent opportunity for our Workforce Investment Board members, local community groups, educational providers, and private nonprofit organizations to really come together to really fully understand and articulate what the local needs are in that particular region of the state. And so that's really a part of this planning process. And then based upon the level of need of that particular organization, the targeted groups that are included in their application, and the performance expectations that we jointly work on negotiating with our local service area partners, that then determines the level of funding that's provided and that's communicated to the federal government.
So, Mr. Norman, when the workforce investment boards decide, is the money split up equally between the 16?
Madam Chair, members of the board, no, it's dependent on the size of the region. As you can see, the Northwest region comprises a very distinct part of the state, a very large part of the state, but also has a unique labor makeup, unique levels of demand, a significant level of disadvantaged workers. And so each of those factors are calculated into what goes into the funding that's provided, the proposed number of individuals served, and then how they're going to go about achieving those goals.
And so number one is I would like to see just a snapshot of how the money is divided between the various 16. What's the process for the community itself to learn how the money is going out? Who gets to have input? You say the boards, but so, for example, would Commissioner Sieben see what the Northwest Central spending their money in a Northeast? And is there, do you go back to Senator Tomasoni and show Senator Tomasoni how that money is shared? What's the oversight process?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the oversight is really on multiple levels. First, locally, levels are communicated to our workforce service area partner, and then that message is communicated through our workforce investment boards, which are typically made up of private industry members and other interested parties that contribute to the local set of solutions that are proposed. So resources are announced annually as a part of their annual contract with DEED, and that information is communicated to our regional legislative officials.
So far, any other questions, members? Senator Sharon.
I find your questioning creates a lot of interest, but I would pick up on something else that you tapped on, and that is it the federal, if these are federal dollars that we're talking about, are the factors that you calculate in the distribution of these dollars federal guidelines, or are they ones that you develop within your own department, and how are those created, and who has input into those, and how are they reviewed periodically?
Madam Chair, Senator Sheeran, that's an excellent question. Given Minnesota's relative economic health compared to other states around the country, we, in a sense, operate on a converse side of the economy where our relative economic success reduces some of the financial resources that we're eligible for relative to other states in the country. And so the resources that are allocated to our different service areas are based on federally derived standards that we negotiate with the Federal Department of Labor. It's an annual negotiation, but again, we are at a slight disadvantage due to the fact that our unemployment rate is so low relative to other states and other economic factors. And so we go in with our commissioner and our assistant commissioner and negotiate those rates annually.
And then further, when you're determining how that money that you do get based on that is distributed in these regions, those same factors are utilized, the unemployment rate in those sections? How are the factors influencing how you distribute this to the workforce centers?
Mr. Norman.
Madam Chair, Senator Sheeran, we use those same factors in terms of unemployment rates, entered employment projections, the level of difficulty that the local areas have proposed of the targeted population, for example, displaced workers, displaced homemakers, levels of veterans, longer term, more discouraged workers, and then some unique population groups that are targeted and located in the different workforce center areas. but they're all really reflective of our federal employment standards that we negotiate annually with the federal government.
And we should also go back to the last slide, because then we're going to talk about the rest of the money too, but thank you for those questions. And then one last question on the federal side of the equation, and I'm sure there'll be more, so I shouldn't say one last. What would you just, if you had to ballpark a number, think that what part of the funds go towards bricks and mortar, just keeping these service area centers around, and really I guess that would be for the workforce center side of things too, but talk about that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's a very limited level of resources that are available for bricks and mortar. The vast majority of the resources are targeted for direct services, which would include vocational counseling, tuition assistance for retraining at technical community colleges or other credential providing institutions. Generally, and depending on the program, the level of what would be considered an administrative resource ranges somewhere between 5 to 10% of the overall allocation.
You piqued my interest with that tuition assistance. How much do you give annually, do you know, in tuition assistance? And do we have any way to have some visibility around that?
We do not have that information with us presently, but we can certainly provide you that information, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay.
Yes, Senator Bonner.
Senator Sharon.
Would DEED be involved in a grant program with a technical college or university that wants to create a robotics program that helps people increase their skills who are already employed and then use these dollars to help cover the costs of that tuition for that working person? Is that the type of participation that DEED would play that's called a tuition assistance?
Mr. Norman?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, that's certainly a possibility in a grant like you would have described. However, in discretionary grants, generally there is, of that particular type, generally there's tuition coverage that would be included in that proposal. Again, it would depend on the particular proposal. But it's certainly a role that DEED plays in helping identify, recruit, assess, and refer unemployed individuals from a variety of circumstances into a very valuable program such as you described that would be beneficial to that person's reemployment.
Thank you. Commissioner?
Madam Chair and members, and the way that we've laid out our presentation today is we thought we'd talk about each program, but focused on the segment of different individuals that targeted populations that we're serving across the state. And so as we go through each individual program, I'm sure there'll be questions, and we welcome those questions. So just final point on this slide, Minnesota also benefits from a workforce development fund, which is an assessment paid by employers dedicated to employment and training programs. And those dollars are paying for important services for our dislocated workers across the state and also for some of our training programs.
So I wanted to spend some time on that, too.
Yep.
So tell us more about, you know, what is that assessment? Mm-hmm. Where does it, who pays it? Just talk more about that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, currently Minnesota has a payroll tax of 0.10% per hour of employed individuals in the state that is utilized to populate the Minnesota Workforce Development Fund. Those resources serve a number of different purposes, but principally are used to help reemploy displaced workers across Minnesota. And this resource has been in place for, I think, the last 10 years, mm-hmm. I believe, and is fully utilized annually. Also is regulated and managed through the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Board, which our commissioner chairs.
So the 13.610 million is on an annual basis?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
And that comes from the assessment from the businesses. Has there ever been any consideration on behalf of the businesses, any request for that also to be looked at for – tuition assistance, for example, when we look at the skills gap and we look at the pipeline needs?
Madam Chair, members, during my time with that board, we have not had that specific request, but we do have very robust conversations amongst the board, which is both public and private sector representatives talking about the economic needs that exist, the targeted populations that are in need of resources, and some, most recently, some innovative ideas on training, knowing that we have a large need there. So in a downturn economy, that fund is very much used for displaced workers.
Yeah.
As our economy improves, and we have less displaced workers across the state, that presents more of an opportunity to be more innovative with those dollars.
And, Commissioner, are there federal restrictions around those dollars? Or are there things in statute that would tie our hands from being able to be creative in that approach?
Madam Chair, members, this is a state-funded program, so there aren't any federally mandated pieces there, but there are statutes in place. We would be happy to pull those for you. But we have, I would say, a very engaged board that's doing some creative thinking at the moment as our economy has improved, and we now have some resources available that we didn't previously have available.
Great. Thanks. And then the general fund. The question?
I was involved in this. It's an unemployment tax.
Right.
It's part of the unemployment system.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an assessment on taxable wages. Mm-hmm. So that's, and it's been used in that budget. And there's a push and pull between the business community and others about whether the appropriate use is for this because it comes from employers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the political dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner and Mr. Fuller, I served on that unemployment commission for a couple of years, and so I know the strict UI portion, there's some very strict guidelines around how that's used, and so this seems to be outside of that then, that it's on top of that, correct, Mr. Fuller?
Yes, the language says, if I can find it right away, for employment development and training programs.
Employment development and training programs. I think that's in our sweet spot. Thank you. Okay, Commissioner, and how about the general fund? Senator Sharon, you're...
Well, I know we need to hear the testimony, but at some point I'd like Mr. Fuller to help me understand the implications of what he was just saying. I'm just trying to get down into what is the conflict that you're talking about and what that might be. It doesn't have to be now, but
no,
at some point
I'd be interested. Mr. Fuller.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, it's not general fund money, so it's an assessment on employers through the unemployment comp system. So historically, they have felt that it should be used for the purposes of, you know, it shouldn't go into the general fund and be used for purposes other than this. And so there's tension to push it out maybe farther away sometimes, and things that some people think maybe are not workforce development and training. And that would be from the, maybe the business, the payer side, say, hey, wait a minute. This is a general fund obligation. Why is this particular pot of money paying for that?
And how, excuse me, Senator Bonner, may I?
Yep,
and,
Senator
Sharon. And where would we track where that's happening?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, that would be in the economic development budget. You'll see, if you look at that bill, that's one of the accounts that mentioned, and then they specify dislocated workers is one, where the money goes. But there's a goodly number of little appropriations out of that fund.
Commissioner, any comments on that discussion? I've been listening to them, too. That's why we're here.
Well, Madam Chair, members, we do have a rather lengthy presentation to give today. And so I'm afraid we won't get through it.
So okay.
If I may start to move through some of the slides, and we'll, of course, take questions. But we do plan to address Job Skills Partnership later in the presentation, and we can talk about that part of the Workforce Development Fund.
And the general fund slice, so that was the only part we didn't talk about.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there is a smaller appropriation from the general fund for programs such as the Minnesota Youth Program, Displaced Homemaker Programs, and a couple of other smaller initiatives that aren't covered fully or even partially by some other federal resources.
Thank you. And Commissioner, I thought this might provoke a lot of questions, and so it's okay if we don't even get through it and we have to finish at another time. It's sure. Good for the this is important work for the committee to understand. Thanks.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, so as I was mentioning, one of the core services that we provide, or the way that we provide our core services, is through our 48 workforce centers that are located across the state. We serve all Minnesotans. Any Minnesotan who walks through those doors will be served by our workforce centers. Job search assistance is available on a first-come, first-served basis, and also includes job search advice, help with resume writing, recommendations for other community-based organizations that are in the area that may be a fit for that particular individual. Some of these services are funded by the Federal Workforce Investment Act, and activities funded from that source are open to everyone, but give priority to individuals who receive public assistance, individuals with low incomes, and veterans. And in 2013, our DEED workforce centers served over 117,000 people. Another great service that DEED provides all job seekers is our online MinnesotaWorks.net, Minnesota's online job bank. The website is 100% free for all users and lists both job vacancies from employers and resumes from job seekers. 593,584 job seekers used the site in 2013. The site listed nearly 600,000 job vacancies in 2013, which was an increase of 9% from 2012. DEED is also a contributor to iSeek, Minnesota's career information website, that received over 2.5 million unique visitors last year. In addition, DEED...
Excuse me, Commissioner. Yes. Senator Pratt.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioner. On this website, for employers posting jobs, is there a fee for that, or is that a service provided by the state? I'm assuming it's free for the applicants. I'm just kind of...
This is a free service for... Madam Chair, members. A free service for both job seekers and employers.
Okay, thank you.
And Madam Chair, do you have any matchmaking results? Do they report how many people found jobs and...
Madam Chair, members, we do report. I receive a monthly report, and so I'd be happy to share that information with you.
Great. And
Senator Sharon.
So we may not get through this, but the jobs that are listed on there, are they a full spectrum of opportunities from engineering to healthcare to accounting services to, manufacturing, does it tend to work towards temporary jobs, or is there an actual capacity there for someone who's, as you were talking about, the long-term unemployed or the person who's having difficulty re-employing that has a lot of competencies? Are they able to be helped in this process?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and members, yes, there are a wide variety of positions, part-time and full-time, various industries that are posted on MinnesotaWorks.net. It is a resource that when an individual walks into our workforce centers that we are guiding them to as one free resource to look at jobs that are available in their area or across the state. And we've seen great success. I think we're constantly looking for ways to get the word out and outreach about MinnesotaWorks.net, making sure that job seekers are aware of this resource and companies are aware of this as well. In addition, DEED's Labor Market Information Office plays a very important role in working with our Workforce Development Division, tracking employment, unemployment, wages by area and industry, occupational employment, job vacancy estimates, employment projections by occupation and industry, business employment dynamics, and occupations in demand. And in the next few slides, we want to talk a little bit about what we're seeing from an economic perspective, and then we'll dive into our workforce development programs. So one of the most important things that we know about our economy in years to come and Deed's workforce is that we're about to experience, the state's workforce, is that we're about to experience a profound demographic shift due to the aging population. The baby boomers who began turning 65 in 2011 are a considerably larger group than any generation that preceded them, and somewhat larger than all of the generations who have followed to date. In 2010, 13% of Minnesota's population was over 65, and by 2030, that segment will account for 21% of the population. In the past decade, Minnesota's economy has had a relatively robust growth in our labor force. However, by the 2020s, we anticipate that the labor force growth rate will be at record low levels as these aging trends continue. Our state's labor force growth has already decelerated to less than 0.5% per year, and it is not expected to experience growth at even that rate until potentially 2035. This stands in sharp contrast to the 1980s and 1990s, in which our labor force grew by an annual average rate of 1.4%. The labor shortage will be one of the biggest issues in our economy in the years to come. And given these demographics, it's important more than ever that we focus on increasing the number of Minnesotans participating in our labor force to ensure Minnesota's economic competitiveness. With that aging labor force in mind, Deed pays close attention to the trends in the unemployment rate among all populations. These trends then inform how we target any flexibility that exists in our workforce development programs. Unfortunately, all populations and demographic groups do not share in Minnesota's unemployment rate of 4.6%. We must ensure that all Minnesotans have access to opportunity. Persons from communities of color, persons with disabilities, the long-term unemployed, face much higher unemployment rates than average. And simultaneously,
excuse me, Commissioner, yes. Do you track the recent college graduates as a subgroup? I'd like to get some employment data because I've heard that they're disproportionately, not recovering the way others are. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, simultaneously, some regions in Minnesota are facing unemployment rates lower than 4.6%, causing businesses to struggle to find workers they need to continue to grow. As the future retirement wave begins to hit the labor market, many more Minnesota businesses will face labor shortages. So with that in mind, we'd like to talk today about a few targeted populations that Deed serves in particular and how we hope to meet these challenges in the coming years. Minnesota's population is rapidly diversifying racially and ethnically. Nearly all of our population growth in the last 12 years has been from communities of color, whose populations have increased 250% since 1990. The percent of Minnesota's population statewide is that non-white or Latino is projected to grow from 14% in 2005 to 25% in 2035. The numbers of Latino, Black, and Asian Minnesotans are all projected to more than double over the next 30 years. The white population is projected to grow slowly and will decline in some parts of the state over the next period. These trends are playing out in many communities statewide, but especially in the Twin Cities metro. In Ramsey County, 48% of the population will be non-white, Hispanic, or Latino by 2030. Hennepin County's non-white population will grow to over 44% during that same time. This rapid growth makes Minnesota's persistent and significant gap in employment in communities of color even more troubling. While the overall state unemployment rate is 4.6% and only 4.3% among whites, Black Minnesotans faced an unemployment rate of 15% in 2013, an increase from 13.8% in 2012. Hispanic and Latino Minnesotans also have an unemployment rate several points higher than the average at 6.8%. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Tom, who will talk about some of our workforce development programs that are targeting these populations.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one new very promising program is our Fast Track Initiative, which stands for Training, Resources, and Credentialing. It's one of our newest and most exciting efforts, and it's focused on communities of color and educationally underprepared and low-income adults. Fast Tracks provides our customers a combination of basic skills education, career-specific training in fields where new skills are in high demand by business. The classroom training component allows students to both learn foundational skills that are fully integrated in the occupational curricula. The Fast Track is geared toward preparing people for living wage jobs with room for advancement. For local employers who are also benefiting by being provided with the skills and the skilled employees they need right now. And the program is also based on an adult career pathways model, which is really a systems change initiative in collaboration with a number of state, local, and national partners. These partners align resources to create meaningful long-term outcomes for adults and lasting efficiencies across state systems. And the program last year received a $3 million appropriation for the fiscal year 1450 biennium and is targeted to serve over 1,000 people in the current program year. Another initiative that has been launched by DEED is the Adult Workforce Competitive Grant Program, which funds organizations providing training to people in targeted population, including people of color, communities of color. Excuse me. DEED provides additional consideration to grant applications focused on veterans, older workers, and individuals who identify with minority groups. Individuals making use of services funded by this program are to obtain, retain, and advance in unsubsidized employment and or to complete training along educational pathways as demonstrated by annual wage increases, placement and retention in jobs, or education and training programs. Populations served benefit a number of ways through this competitive funding model. We're identifying newer and different service providers with innovative ideas that are expert in reducing barriers for entry into new employment. Through the competitive process, DEED is able to prioritize projects based on labor markets and regional unemployment or employment needs. And a competitive funding model also allows DEED to leverage investment from other state agencies and partners. The competitive grant process also allows for improved taxpayer accountability through more standardized publications and programmatic outcomes. Overall, this program has distributed over $9 million since its inception in 2011, of which $8 million went to organizations specifically proposing to serve low-income individuals or people transitioning from public assistance, communities of color, and/or immigrants and refugees. As Commissioner Clark Sieben mentioned, the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership also has components which target low-income workers. The purpose of the low-income worker training program is to help individuals with incomes at or below 200% of the federal poverty guidelines, under $47,700 for a family of four, to receive training to acquire additional skills in order to move up the career ladder and to higher-paying jobs leading to economic self-sufficiency. The program is also designed to provide block grants to eligible applicants who then cover the cost of training for eligible individuals. The training initiative is funded by the Low-Income Worker Training Program as a part of the Job Skills Partnership Program and is intended to be flexible and responsive in order to maximize the ability of funded programs to adapt to changes in economic and business conditions.
Excuse me, Mr. Norman.
Yes.
When the adults receive these grants, can they get trained at our MNSCU facilities, or is it, I mean, tell us about the training.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, these grants go to a variety of different community organizations who are expert in serving and providing really case management, vocational-based counseling to individuals to help them identify a viable career path and which will lead to long-term family-sustaining occupations. Based on that interaction with vocational counselors, a career plan is established and really the necessary steps identified to how to bring that person forward both through training, ultimate employment, and then supportive services that follow. So the training or the tuition that's provided is really to cover that individual's costs of training and support services while they're in school.
So I'm still not certain. So can they use that money for direct tuition reimbursement?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, absolutely.
And at just any institution in Minnesota?
The institute, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the institutions that are covered typically are a Minsky-based institution, but they are not limited to the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Dunwoody College of Technology, other proprietary institutions are utilized, but the vast provider of this education is through our state colleges and universities.
And could you provide me, I don't expect it today, but could you provide me with exactly how much money is going towards tuition of the Job Skills Partnership money?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members.
And where it's going?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, absolutely.
Thank you very much. And also, I'd be interested in hearing the percent of people who utilize this service get actual certificates or degrees.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we can provide that information as well.
Thank you.
In addition to the low-income worker grant programs, we also have the youth program development competitive grants. And while most of DEED's funding and programs focus on adults, research has increasingly shown that the number one predictor of future success in the workforce is early exposure to work experience. This is an area where Minnesota excels, and with the rapidly aging workforce, this exposure to career experience early in an individual's career planning and career thinking is critical to their future development and participation in the workforce. Our Office of Youth Development provides resources, special initiatives, and grants for low-income and at-risk individuals between the ages of 14 and 21. This office administers the Minnesota Youth Program, the Minnesota Youth Workforce Development Competitive Grant Program, and provides services to an exceptionally disadvantaged group of young people who are about to enter the workforce in various ways. Structured much like the Adult Workforce Competitive Grants, these funds provide vital experience and guidance to help prepare Minnesota's neediest young people to succeed. DEED has awarded more than $8 million in youth workforce development competitive grants since 2011 to both smaller organizations and well-known programs like Step Up in the city of Minneapolis.
So, excuse me, Mr. Norman, so College Possible, would that be another one who might get a grant, or it's strictly employment related?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not as familiar with that program, but I can check and get that information back to you. In addition, while teen unemployment contributes to significant higher wages as young adults enter their 20s, teens in low-income families have at least access to jobs, especially jobs that combine part-time work and school. To address this disparity, DEED's Minnesota Youth Program assists youth ages 14 to 21 lacking academic and applied skills that are considered critical for current and future workplace needs. The program specifically focuses on youth that are at risk. 49% of disabilities, 43% are on public assistance, and 20% are system-involved youth. Participants are provided an opportunity to earn a paycheck, gain valuable work experience, apply classroom training, and develop their work readiness skills. The Minnesota Youth Program improves participants' grades, attendance, graduation rates, and kids in programs like this are also much more likely to stay in school and graduate on time. All Minnesota Youth Program services are provided through a network of public and private nonprofit youth service providers, workforce centers, and partnerships with local education agencies. The Minnesota Youth Program received $7 million in funding for the current biennium. In addition, the Minnesota Youth Build Program is another key investment in the future of our workforce. That program provides job training in housing, construction, leadership development, and life skills, and a commitment to community service for young people who are at risk of dropping out of high school, getting involved in criminal behavior, gang activity, chemical abuse, abuse, homelessness, and other negative behaviors. In the process, it enables young people to gain useful job skills while working toward their high school diploma or GED, and helps them play their respective roles in their communities and build the most essential commodity needed by families and neighbors, safe, affordable housing. Finally, DEED provides a variety of other services to disadvantaged youth through the Federal Workforce Investment Act program. Services provided through local workforce investment boards and youth councils include paid and unpaid work experience and internships, adult mentoring, leadership development, occupational skills training, alternative secondary school services, comprehensive guidance and counseling, support services, summer employment opportunities, tutoring, tutoring, study skills training, dropout prevention services, as well as follow-up. 44% of the youth served in this program in program year 2012 were from communities of color, 33% from families receiving public assistance, and 18% were foster youth or juvenile offenders. These services are paid for by approximately a $10 million investment in federal funding for fiscal year 14. While these programs only represent a portion of what we do and our efforts in this area, they give you some idea of the scale of the efforts and our commitment to serving our young people.
So, Mr. Norman, with regard to the Job Skills Partnership, we saw where the money comes from for the Workforce Development Fund. Where does the money come from for the Job Skills Partnership? Mm-hmm. Or Commissioner, which either?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership, and this is my current understanding, mm-hmm. receives an annual allocation from the general fund of approximately $8 million to fund the educational partnerships that take place between businesses and educational institutions to develop new curricula designed to meet emerging occupations. That's one wing of the Job Skills Partnership. The second area of funding focuses on the unemployment insurance 0.10% assessment that populates the Minnesota Workforce Development Fund. And those resources are primarily targeted toward displaced workers.
Right. But those resources go to the Workforce Development Fund, not the Job Skills. So the Job Skills Partnership Fund is just coming from the general fund? I'm not clear.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the statute would indicate that the need for displaced workers from the Minnesota Workforce Development Fund comes first, and then the board will review based on an economic assessment presentation provided by Dr. Steve Hine on what resources potentially would be needed in the future, allows us to shift additional resources to the Job Skills Partnership to meet emerging business needs when the level of dislocations and unemployed individuals served through the program is in decline. Mm-hmm.
Got it. And I guess that's why I would like to see the data with regard to the, you know, young people, recent college graduates, the 18 to 25, whatever, to look at that group's unemployment rate. Again, in just an intuitive sense, I just have a sense that when we look at our future workforce needs, that perhaps one of the best ways that we could be using our resources is to get those young people trained, and trained not just, you know, for one business, but with a certificate or a degree. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, another key population that DEED serves is people with disabilities and the blind and visually impaired. Nationally, people with disabilities are 50% less likely to participate in the workforce, and for those that do participate, almost twice as likely to be unemployed. Here in Minnesota, 47.7% of working-age people with disabilities are employed, compared to 81.8% of working-age people without disabilities. These numbers are particularly troubling given how fast the American disabled population is growing. Between 1990 and 2000, for example, the number of Americans with disabilities increased 25%. In addition to high unemployment rates, disabled people are nearly twice as likely as people without disabilities to have an annual household income of $15,000 or less. 25.3% of working-age people with disabilities in Minnesota are living under the poverty level, compared with 9.1% of people without disabilities. Disabled individuals want to work. They bring innovative perspectives to the table. With life difficulties that require creative adaptation and ingenuity on a daily basis, disabled individuals know resilience. This data, recent studies show employers who hire people with disabilities report a higher level of dedication and increased retention. And according to the U.S. Department of Education, workers with disabilities are rated consistently as average or above average in performance, quality and quantity of work, flexibility, and attendance. So DEED's workforce development programs are making sure that Minnesota's workers and businesses are thriving. One of DEED's key programs for people in this area is extended employment. These services provide ongoing employment support for Minnesotans with significant disabilities.
Excuse me, Commissioner.
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if you wouldn't mind, if you could just focus your remarks today on the things that touch the higher ed kind of purview.
Okay.
And so just because I know we've got Dolly, too. So, of course, we have the right to ask you hundreds of questions, but then we ask you to shorten your presentation. So I apologize.
Do you want to dislocate a worker? Okay.
And we agree with its importance. I'm just –
yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, so though Minnesota weathered the recession far better than most states – layoffs and unemployment are still an issue, and Minnesotans who have recently lost their jobs, of course, have one urgent question: what now do we do? DEED has several programs that help those workers manage their finances and support their efforts to find a new job. And one of those programs that we've mentioned is the Dislocated Worker Program, and reports up through Tom. So Tom's going to share some information today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Dislocated Worker Program is a key investment for the state of Minnesota in helping individuals who have lost their jobs through no fault of their own attain family-sustaining reemployment. It's a significant effort within our agency and our division, and it served over 17,000 people in fiscal year 2013. When a large plant closes, we have a rapid response team that is literally the first on the scene following the receipt of a WARN letter, which is the federally required advisory when there's going to be a large-scale workforce change. Based on this advice, we then will partner with the employer to really work with them as the individuals are being downsized and look for a competitive process to select a reemployment service provider that steps back and really looks at each individual, their personal employment goals, their educational history, their academic background, and their vocational goals. And based on that assessment, we will work with them to develop a plan which does include higher funding in higher education, credentialing programs, degree completion, oftentimes academic preparation, GED preparation, a variety of things based on that individual's life goal and efforts to get them back into the workforce. So higher education plays an absolutely fundamental role in that process and the overall plan of getting people who've had their careers interrupted back into productive employment. Veterans.
Yes, Senator Claussen.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, I'm curious, the people that are in this program, generally how long are they being assisted? Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of curious about what the average amount of assistance dollar-wise that the average person would receive.
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Claussen, it's an excellent question. Typically, people will stay in a program from 1 to 2 years, depending on their personal circumstances. Many individuals can transition from unemployment to reemployment quite quickly. If they're an accountant and they want to return to being an accountant, there's a fairly straightforward plan to really help that individual. And sometimes retraining isn't a part of that process. But in many cases, we will find people that are at mid-careers that have not been active in updating their educational backgrounds. They may not have finished a degree. They may have a particular interest in an area that we can help them identify and help them enroll in. Typically, somewhere between $3,000 to $5,000 is available per person for tuition resources to help them in this process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As I was closing with, we would also like to talk about a part of Dislocated Worker Services. The Trade Adjustment Assistance Act is a part of legislation that was created after the NAFTA legislation, really to help mitigate the effects of individuals who had lost their job due to international trade agreements. This is a very effective program that assists workers who are laid off and helping them return to the workforce as quickly as possible through help with work search or job searches, relocation, job training, and other reemployment benefits. Two major components are funded separately by the U.S. Department of Labor, trade adjustment allowances, which are special extensions to unemployment insurance, and trade adjustment assistance, which also includes the reimbursement of training costs, job search allowances, relocation allowances, and similar expenses. The program is available to workers who lose their job or have had their hours reduced or income affected by increased foreign trade activity, and the U.S. Department of Labor must certify a petition for a given layoff site. Individuals from certified sites are eligible to access TAA and or TRA services, and those benefits include certification for health care coverage, tax credits, which provides financial assistance for health insurance premium costs, and reemployment trade adjustment resources provide a wage supplement benefit that are eligible or available to eligible workers over 50 years old.
Madam Chair, members, another key population for DEED's Workforce Development Services is our veterans. Even though Minnesota has no active military base, over 350,000 veterans call Minnesota home, of whom we serve more than 15,000 each year. While the national unemployment rate for veterans is below average, the unemployment rate for post-9/11 veterans still runs significantly higher. Though these trends tend to be correlated with higher unemployment among younger people generally, veterans face a number of unique challenges that DEED works to address. And as Governor Dayton has said, after their service to our country, any unemployed veteran is one too many.
Though there are many other DEED programs that include veterans in their target populations, we also serve veterans specifically. And we have specially trained staff that outreach to the veterans community and are very effective in talking veteran to veteran and really helping them address their employment goals. Our primary customers are Minnesota veterans, which include the Minnesota National Guard and Reserves, who also meet the statutory definition of an eligible veteran. Our veteran service representatives are located at our 48 workforce centers across Minnesota and are targeting a high-risk or in-need population of veterans looking for reemployment. Services are provided to transitioning service members who have been released also from the military in the last 36 months. And in addition, DEED staff reach out to businesses to develop job opportunities for veterans and play an instrumental role in Minnesota's Beyond the Yellow Ribbon campaign and National Guard reintegration program. DEED also runs the largest annual Veterans Career Fair in the state, and the next one, and you're all invited, is July 9th. So please add it to your calendars. And in the past, up to 10 to 15% of veterans find find positions on the spot at this type of career fair. DEED's Veterans Employment Services provided services to almost 7,000 veterans last year.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, at just over 4 million Americans unemployed for 27 weeks or longer, the problem of long-term unemployment has been easing, but it's still a bigger issue than it's been at nearly any time in our history. More than a third of the officially unemployed have been so for 6 months or longer. While these trends impact the young, low-income adults, communities of color, and the less educated, older workers and the highly educated have also been significantly impacted.
DEED also provides a number of our programs through DEED specifically focus on the needs of the long-term unemployed. They include our adult competitive grants, fast track, displaced worker services, trade adjustment assistance, and other workforce services. And we're really finding that our ability to outreach to long-term unemployed individuals is becoming increasingly effective in our ability to draw these people back into the workforce.
And Madam Chair, members, finally, DEED also provides a variety of services to businesses in need of training programs for their incumbent workers. We've already covered job skills partnership quite a bit, so I think I'll go on to the next slide, other incumbent worker training.
Our business services representatives also are in touch with area businesses around the state on an ongoing basis, and a part of this service is really to work with them, coaching businesses in helping them reach out and hire in increasingly competitive job markets. Our services include helping find qualified workers, analyzing hard-to-fill positions, coaching companies in writing effective job descriptions, obtaining tax credits and on-the-job training for new hires, reviewing bonding information, and helping determine competitive salaries. We also work with employers to train employees that they already have through incumbent worker retraining programs and dislocated worker and other activities.
So, Madam Chair, members, in conclusion, Minnesota's labor force is made up of over 4 million individuals, all of whom are potential customers of the Workforce Center system. In the program year 2012, DEED's workforce system served over 305,000 individuals, or 7.3% of the total population. While our economy has recovered well, we need to make sure it's working for everyone and do even more work to prepare for the challenges of the future with our aging workforce. We look forward to working with all of you, and at this point, we'll open up for any additional questions you have.
Commissioner, do you think that the relationship that the workforce centers have with our MNSCU system is as developed as you'd like it? Do you have any comments on that?
Madam Chair and members, we work very closely with the MNSCU system, and I think there's some excellent new thinking underway between DEED's workforce development team and the MNSCU system. We do have a few workforce centers that are on site at a MNSCU institution and have found that to be a very valuable location so that we can directly engage with students that are on site, and the workforce center is in constant communication with that local campus. So we've seen some excellent results there, and I think it's something we should continue exploring for some of our other locations.
Yeah, it does make sense. I know, Senator Sharon, you've got it. It's Mankato. Where else is it? Winona?
Mm-hmm.
And
I think there's three, but I don't.
Rainy Lake.
Hutchinson.
Rainy Lake.
Mm-hmm.
Dave.
We're going to have the Workforce Center update.
Workforce Center in Rainy Lake.
Yeah. Members, if you remember, we did pass the pilot last session to have the Workforce Centers actually go into the high schools to provide career counseling, and so we're not talking about that today, but we'll get to see someone back here with us to report on that. So any other questions? We really appreciate the overview. It probably created more questions than it answered. Senator Claussen.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. We have a mental health workforce development task force that's going on. Indeed, has been really helpful in providing information on employment trends. And one of the issues that we've run across, though, is in terminology. In the field, there are certain mental health positions that are not identified the same way that DEED does. Hmm. I'm just wondering how you go about identifying those specific workforce positions within an occupation, and how do we ensure that we have then the very best information that we're working with?
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Claussen, that's an excellent question, and it really relates to how different organizations define job skills or job competencies. And it is quite a challenge because one organization will define a particular set of skills that are required in one fashion, whereas another will provide it in a very different format. So part of the work that we're doing through our business service representatives is really to increase the skill level of our team to really talk more concretely about using common languages around job descriptions, competency frameworks, and in really writing very effective job descriptions. And that also relates to training that's required in the community, and we have those same conversations with our educational partners. But it is something of a challenge.
Mm-hmm. This committee is going to be looking at the whole apprenticeship question and looking at the German model. And one of the things that takes place in the German model is they have very clear standards with regard to vocations. And so you'll see it next week, the initial bill, but that's the way we're going to begin is by picking industries and coming up with standards. And any other questions? Well, Commissioner, it's a breath of fresh air to have you here and to hear about your work, and I think that we have an advantage by having a Commissioner of Deed of your generation, because I think you can bring fresh eyes to the challenges before us. And so I have been really surprised by the amount of money that goes into this area. And, you know, that it comes from the feds and it comes from our own business community. And so I do ask us to think newly, where is the best use of that very large, you know, income stream? And so I certainly am impressed by all that you've done and the providers have done over time. But as the workforce is aging out and our biggest challenge is with the one coming up, you know, let's make sure that we are willing to look at things in a new way. So thank you. And you, Mr. Nelson, pretty good job for somebody just started. So
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Anyone else? Okay, thank you. And Dolly, Commissioner, has been so patient. So thank you, Commissioner Peterson. And Mr. Rakowski, but I think he might have stepped out. Commissioner, did Mr. Rakowski step out?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Whatsoever. He moves around a lot.
Okay, good. Well, we're glad to have you here. Welcome.
My name's Ken Peterson. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. And what I'm going to do today is just give you a quick overview of our apprenticeship section, the work we do in that area, and what some of our goals are and how it operates.
Thank you.
And it'll be a relatively quick overview. The Department of Labor and Industry, though, is basically a regulatory agency. We do mostly workplace issues, handle workers' comp.
Excuse me,
OSHA.
Commissioner, why don't you put your put that down so we can and we can.
I was trying to hide, not.
There.
Thank unfortunately, you caught me out.
Okay, good.
And we handle a number of a variety of workplace issues: workers' comp, OSHA, labor standards, construction code licensing, and also apprenticeships. Apprenticeships is actually our smallest division. We have 6 employees. It's funded out of the workforce development funds that we get every year or every biennium. And it's a relatively, as I said, it's a relatively small amount of money, but we are funded out of there.
How much is small?
Less than $1 million.
Okay.
I want to say around $800,000, but I really don't have the numbers here. But
thank you.
If you like. But it's less. It's not a lot of money. So it basically pays for salary and their, you know, driving, that sort of thing. The way apprenticeship is, as you probably all know, is an old way of on-the-job learning. Benjamin Franklin was an apprentice. We've had several presidents who have been presidents or have been apprentices, and it's been a time-honored system of learning. As the chairman discussed, in Germany, it's a very popular way of training people. Something like 60% of young people from the age of 16 or 18 on go through an apprenticeship system, and many of those go on to college after that. But it's a very popular system. Our system in this country is not set up the same way. We don't have the same unanimity of the way we do things. However, I think apprenticeship is a great way of learning, and I'm a big believer in hoping to expand it in a variety of ways over time. But just to go through the steps of how it's our apprenticeship system works. We're sort of chartered under the federal government, the 1937 Apprenticeship Act, and so we receive our authority under the federal government to regulate apprenticeship. So it's basically, it's a federal system that's given to the states. And actually, this year, we are updating our law as according to what the feds wants to do, so there will be a bill coming before some of the other committees, not before this committee. But the way it works is that first we set up, the employer working with us sets up apprenticeship standards, and then we certify them as a what we call a joint apprenticeship committee. Then you hire an apprentice. And the apprentice is informed of how it works, what the hours, what the requirements will be, and what sort of progression she or he should anticipate as they go through the program. Then we certify it. We reach an apprenticeship agreement signed between the individual. After we certified it, the apprenticeship agreement is signed between the individual learner and the company. And then the typical wage they get is something around $14 to $20. And the programs we have, it's a minimum of 144 hours of classroom learning and a minimum of 2,000 hours of on-the-job learning. The maximum program we have, though, I think is about 8,000. It's one of the electrician programs, 8,000 on-the-job learning.
And now, Commissioner, some of those programs, I'm sorry, excuse me. How does the 144 translate to credits?
Sometimes they're done for credits, sometimes they're not. Sometimes it's a lot more than 144 hours. I know one EJ Ajax company in Fridley, I believe. They have he basically pays for to get a 2-year degree for the students to get a 2-year degree or a 4-year degree if they keep working on and they as they work on the apprenticeship program. Others, there's no credits at all.
Okay.
Oftentimes they're done. Some of the construction industries, most use their own facilities. They don't use MinSKU or any other. Others do use MinSKU. That varies from trade to trade, setup to setup. And they have their own. Maybe some of you have seen some of the construction trades training facilities. They're all very good, and they hit some of the areas they need to hit on. Then what the apprentice goes through, their first, second, third, fourth year, whatever it is, and when they complete their program, they receive a certificate. It's in the construction trades, it's called a journey certificate, although it may not have to be called an equivalent certificate. They have a certificate that allows a certain amount of mobility, of transportability. You can go from state to state or from business to business and say that I'm a good, I've completed my apprenticeship. I'm a journey worker in Brick Lane or a glazer or whatever it is. And that shows that I'm a skilled craftsman, that I can do the job. And so that way, if you want to move to California, if you're in California, you want to move here for the weather, you certainly can do that. And so it's a good program, though. It's like a college degree in the trades. So it's a wonderful certificate. You get a completion certificate, and we sign them and send them out. Right now, in the apprentices, under the apprenticeship system in Minnesota, we have something like nearly 8,000 apprentices. It went down to 5,500 during the recession, but now it's up to 8,000. And that varies almost from month to month because you have a certain number of people leaving the program and a certain number of people coming in. They're each done on their own terms. As long as we approve the apprenticeship agreement or the apprenticeship program, as long as it provides the learning that's needed in whatever the objectives are. Let's see. We passed out this thing, which is just our newsletter we put out quarterly. And on the cover is the head of our apprenticeship program, Johnny Burns, who had a medical procedure today, so he couldn't come. But then in the second, later on, you'll see some of the issues that come up in apprenticeship, or some of the things. On the second page, there's an article on a plumber who's just retired, was an apprenticeship coordinator. Then on the page, the bottom half, there's a Minnesota Municipal Utility Association, their apprentices. One of the most common forms of apprenticeships are through utilities for power plant operation, that sort of thing. Then we have our, as we have in all of our publications, we have our performance measurements, and then one of our youth programs. We're trying to attract young people into construction trades. The construction trades, just like other areas, are losing a lot of people, will be losing a lot of people in the next few years. And so we have a concentrated effort to go into high schools and go into other places, try to attract people into the trades. One of the areas is called Construct Tomorrow. We had a Construct Tomorrow event 2 days ago in Roseville, and we had like 200 students there who were interested in going into construction trades, or at least interested in learning about it. So those are good things. And then the last page we have just some healthcare discussion of some healthcare programs that we're in. Let's see. 7% of our apprentices today are female. I'm not quite sure why that's so low. Some of it's just the historic construction trades are male dominated. We're trying to get more, but that's 7%. And 18% are minority. I think about 85% of apprentices in Minnesota are in the construction trades, though.
Commissioner, I wondered when you said the 8,000, I wondered if you do have a list of the industries. You don't have to have it today, but
here, I can give you a few. I will give you a list, but
okay.
Some information on it. The largest single apprenticeship program is the construction laborers. That has 2,200. The carpenters are 709, electricians, construction electricians 705, sheet metal workers 305, roofers 384, and plumbers 366. For the non-construction trade programs, the refrigerator mechanics have 170, firefighters 78, health support specialists 150, power line workers 110, power plant operators 37. But I can get you the variety.
Hey, Commissioner, are those 8,000, what percentage would you say roughly are union positions?
The construction trades probably, in the construction trades, probably 90% of them are going through union programs.
Yeah.
About 10% probably aren't. And I think it's around 85%. I'm not going to back out the figures right here, but 85% of the total apprentices are in the construction trades. I'd say somewhere around 90% are probably in some union programs. And those I want to emphasize those. All the construction programs are completely self-funded.
Right.
They're not funded by any outside sources.
One of the challenges we have in expanding this model is if we're to expand in industries that are outside of what are traditionally union industries, we want to make sure to send the message, and that's why I'm saying it on the record, that we in no way want to infringe upon or replace in any way those, you know, robust programs that are actually doing an amazing job. I've visited the carpenters and talked to their students, and, you know, we've looked at several programs. And so this committee's interest is more in seeing what we can glean from what's worked and then expand that to serve more students in more industries and to use that model to fulfill the demand in other emerging industries.
Yeah, I'd agree with that because, for one thing, they're funding themselves. They're not coming to the state government or the federal government or local government asking for any money. They're funding themselves. To me, that's great. And so they know what they need to know, the things they need to learn in their profession, so they don't have to get tied up in whatever government operations there are. And there are a number of other reasons why they're very good programs. They're very effective. We have a top-notch construction force in our country. We build good stuff, and so we should try to keep it. What we need to do, though, is like you're trying to do, Madam Chairman, is train other people to do the type of high-quality work that other countries are able to do and
right.
maintain that leadership we've had in the past and make it grow in the future.
And so the economic model is the one that is really a question because, for example, in Germany, the industries themselves do sponsor the education. And the Germany puts in a substantial amount towards that. And so
I went on a tour last year with the University of Minnesota to Germany. It was in the Stuttgart area. And it's pretty impressive how the three legs of it were industry, government, and the students or educational system. It works very well together. But that's sort of maybe an accident of history. But we don't have it, and they do have it. and they have something like 325, 340 different construction or different trades, apprenticeship trades, with their standards written up, and they range from being a pharmacist to being a bricklayer,
and a banker and an accountant.
Baker and an accountant, but thankfully we keep them away from being lawyers because we want to maintain the integrity of the law. I say as a lawyer, I'm sorry.
That's right, my husband too.
We'll keep out the competition as much as possible.
Commissioner, do you have any thoughts about how we might get our business community interested in having more of a financial stake in this conversation?
Madam Chairman, members, I'm not quite sure. I've thought a lot about this, and it can be in part because when you talk to the Germans, you ask them, what areas do you have the most problems? And they say, with American companies operating in Germany. Because we have very successful companies operating in Germany and elsewhere, America. But we have a different outlook on things. And so a lot of firms are hesitant to train people and then see them go to a competitor. I think that's one of the chief problems. And In America, we as a people, we have more mobility. We may not have the same kind of lifelong relationship with an employer just because of who we are as a people. And that's one of the most difficult things. So employers recognize that their potential employees may leave, and the employees recognize the employers may make them leave. And so overcoming that is the trick we have to do. I'm not quite sure how to do it.
Thank you. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wish Commissioner Sieben were still here, because I'm starting to put together some things. And it seems to me, how does your relationship or how do you work with the workforce development centers? Because what we're hearing is we have a shortage of workers. We have high unemployment in certain areas. We've got apprenticeship programs. We've got all these different programs going. But how are they working together? And because there seems to be an opportunity that's either being missed or not fully taken advantage of.
Commissioner?
Senator Pratt, Madam Chairman, members. I think it varies from apprenticeship program to program and from workforce center to workforce center. We certainly do have a lot of referrals from workforce centers to different apprenticeship programs. At the same time, a lot of the apprenticeship programs only have 3, 4, 5, 6 apprentices at a time. And so they may not have a lot of room to bring people on. But there are referrals that go on. And we do spend a lot of time working with DEED and with the various workforce centers. At the same time, apprenticeship is a relatively small program. And each program is going to be finding its trainees or apprentices in their own fashion. If I'm a nursing home in, was it Pine City or wherever that one was from in this article, they may just be people have gotten jobs, was it in Rushford, that people just may have walked in the door and they put them in an apprenticeship program. Or they may have gone through a workforce center. So it just varies. Each of these programs are going to be different.
But, you know, Senator Pratt, I agree with you, and that's why I was so interested in really understanding who's paying for that workforce development fund. So the business community is putting money in, mm-hmm. and that money is going towards job training. But this is another area of job training, and so they are participating, and perhaps if they were invited into this conversation, they might like to participate in a different way.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just thinking through as we see needs for workers, high unemployment, high long-term unemployment. We're talking about opportunities to expand. It just seems to me that we've got conflicting data, mm-hmm. right? We've got conflicting problems. We either have too many jobs or not enough jobs, too many workers or not enough workers, and what it really comes down to is skills. Mm-hmm. And making sure that we've got the right skills and we're encouraging the right skills to be developed. And this may be one opportunity to do that, but it means that we've got to be working together. And I guess maybe that's what I'm missing in some of these presentations
is the synergy that's being created between the programs.
Great. And it looks like Ms. Babine may want to have a comment, too, from Deed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kim Babe, I'm the Director of Government Affairs at Deed, and just wanted to speak to your point, Madam Chair, Senator Pratt. Thank you for your comments, and they are very well taken. I wanted to give you a little preview of a week from today, the committee has asked Deed to come and Dolly to talk about a few programs that are getting exactly at the problem that you mentioned, or the opportunity also. We have, last year, the legislature put into place a few programs that are getting at exactly that. There's a customized training program that was put into place that we are working very closely with Dolly on. The money was appropriated to Deed, but we are doing it very much in conjunction with Dolly. There was also a bill to, you heard a little bit about our labor market information part of Deed, and so we know where jobs in demand are, and we know where the people are, and so really working on how do we present that information and share that information and push it and track it in a way that can be really helpful so that we're getting more of that alignment. And I think there's just really exciting things going on between agencies, education, higher education, Dolly, Deed, others there, you know, could go on, and our higher education institutions, U of M, Minsky, those. So I think there's some, we're moving in the right direction, not to say that we're there. There's more work to be done, but your point is very well taken.
The
Commissioner.
The program she's talking about is, we have a manufacturer's program. We have operating in four different schools, mm-hmm. the Alexandria Tech, Central Lakes in Brainerd, Hennepin Technical College in Hennepin County, and Century Technical Community College in White Bear Lake. And that's a custom manufacturing program. And it just started just now, so we can't really give. We'll be talking more about how it's set up to work. We're not quite sure how well it's going to work. We hope it's going to work well. We think it's a great idea. Basically, it's trying to get manufacturers buying in, or, you know, employers buying into it and seeing some real advantage for them.
Great. Thank you. Okay.
That's that really wraps up. I think one thing I wanted to point out, we are also working on trying to implement diversity goals in construction. As I said earlier, and I think that Commissioner Clark Stephen mentioned it too, the construction industries are losing a lot of people. The workforce is changing a lot. We have a real concentrated effort to attract not only young people, not just young people in general, but also minorities, racial minorities, and women into construction trades. And so we're working very hard. We required each of the construction apprenticeship programs to increase the numbers of minorities they have in their programs. Historically, up until the last 20, maybe 30 years, there was, I think, maybe a bias in construction industries against minorities. I think that's gone now. I don't think it exists anymore at all. Now it's a question of just encouraging people to get in these trades and see that they can make a real difference and they can have a very good economic life and a very productive career.
Thank you, Commissioner. I remember Senator Mimoy, when I first went to the legislature, every, you know, year she would go through, you know, asking MnDOT to report on the minorities, and she'd stand up on the Senate floor and talk about how important that was. So it's good to hear we're making progress.
Madam Chair, hopefully that in a couple of years you'll be able to stand on the Senate floor, too, and make good reports.
Good. So thank you, members, for your attentiveness. I know various people had to go to different places, but we really appreciate the presentation from you, Commissioner, and the one from Deed, and from the members' discussion. So